morning. It's my pleasure this morning to introduce to you Professor Sherman Jackson. He's the King Faisal Chair of Islamic Thought and Culture and Professor of Religion and American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California. He was formerly the Arthur F. Thurneau Professor of Near Eastern Studies, Visiting Professor of Law, and Professor of Afro-American Studies at the University of Michigan. He taught at various American institutions before that, and before that he got his PhD in Islamic Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. I first encountered Professor Sherman's work in an article he wrote comparing American concepts and laws regarding terrorism with Islamic concepts and laws regarding terrorism, and that's become a staple in my classes. But I believe he's probably more well known for his various books, including Islamic Law and the State, The Constitutional Jurisprudence of Shahab al-Din al-Qarafi from Brill, at which point he changed allegiances to Oxford, and everything seems to come from Oxford since then. So On the Boundaries of Theological Tolerance in Islam, Abu Hamid al-Ghazali's Faisal al-Tafrika, and then more recently, Islam and the Black American, Looking Towards the Third Resurrection in 2005, and Islam and the Problem of Black Suffering in 2009, and then most recently, just last year, Sufism for Non-Sufis. He has been recognized as one of the leading experts on Islam in America, and in 2009, he was named among the 500 most influential Muslims in the world by the Royal Islamic Strategic Studies Center of Amman, Jordan, and the Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Center for Muslim Christian Understanding. So I'm sure you agree with me, we're really pleased to have him with us this morning, and he will be speaking on My Body, This Paper, This Fire, The Future of Violence in Islam. Please join me in welcoming Professor Sherman Jackson.
Thank you very much, Heather, for that very kind and gracious introduction. I want to apologize beforehand for my voice. I moved to the Los Angeles area about a year and a half ago, and I've been much warmer since I've been out here from Michigan, but I've also been much sicker, so I'm not sure what to make of all that. I hope my voice holds up, and I apologize in the interim for any inconveniences that might come out of that. I'm going to jump into my paper directly, but let me say beforehand that my area of specialization is primarily, as Heather indicated, Islamic studies, and my focus has been primarily on Islamic law and theology, both in the pre-modern and in the modern context. Anyone familiar with the writings of the late Michel Foucault will recognize the first part of my title as coming from an article he wrote in response to the late Jacques Derrida, and before him, Descartes, apparently over the role, nature, and authority of human reason. I must confess that as a non-philosopher, and perhaps even more so as a non-continental philosopher, I understood precious little of this article, and I suspect that I may have been in some fairly eminent company in this regard. But every serious scholar of the Islamic religious sciences is also at least an amateur litterateur. The pre-modern liberal arts trivium of grammar, logic, and rhetoric being fundamental to a classical Muslim education. On this connection, not only was I moved by Foucault's allegorical associations, his verbal naughtiness took me back to some of my fondest memories as a graduate student and the many pre-Islamic, classical, and even contemporary friends I made, from the ancient and classical Arab poets Al-A'sha, Abu Nawaz, Abu Tamam, and of course, Al-Mutanabbi, to such controversial moderns as Adonis. And me, I am the master of light. But in order to touch the farthest reaches of my being, I cast off myself on occasion, and I step outside my own footsteps, and I crown myself king in the name of my light cast upon the darknesses. On more substantive grounds, that was Adonis, by the way, not Foucault. On more substantive grounds, Foucault had raised the question of the distinction between dreams on the one hand and madness on the other. Madness is, of course, a cognitive decoupling from reality, whereby we indulge all kinds of fears, judgments, and associations that have no basis in the real world. The same is true, however, of dreams, where we slay dragons, climb tall buildings made of yogurt, and have sex with people whose names and faces we can't seem to remember. To the extent that we all dream, and dreaming is indelibly woven into the human condition, Foucault seemed to be implying that madness, or at least our exposure to something akin to it, may never be far from the surface. As such, even as healthy, rational beings, we may be far more susceptible than we think to the perilous paradise of magical thinking, a quotidian consciousness routinely guided, if not actually driven, by an unconscious, pre-rational indulgence of utter nonsense. Hyperbole aside, part of what Foucault seems to be suggesting here is that the value and integrity of our words and understandings are significantly indebted to the frame of mind, or if you will, the state of consciousness in which we produce or acquire them. This, to my mind, bears an important, if not obvious, significance for any attempt to discuss a matter such as the relationship between Islam and violence, especially in this our post-9/11 world, and even more especially, perhaps, across the various religious and civilizational boundaries that define our respective points of departure. For such exchanges invariably attempt to speak across any number of liminal spaces, that is, between Islam and the West, between Christianity or Judaism and secular liberal democracy, indeed, between our heartfelt desire for peace and fraternity and our quiet addiction to power and domination. All of this raises clear and unavoidable challenges, not only for the accuracy and integrity of our claims and characterizations, but also for the degree of credibility we might reasonably expect these to command. To a large extent, the future of violence in Islam is very much a function of how not only Muslims, but also non-Muslims understand and relate to their respective pasts. This is because the relationship between Islam and the West on the one hand, and modern Muslims and the classical legacy of Islam on the other, is fundamentally, and it seems inexorably, informed by umbilical ties to some or another construction of history. This is not just another way of repeating the notion that the Crusades explain everything. It does take seriously, however, the fact that what eventually became the West did so, at least in part, in response to Islam. If nothing else, the very discovery of America and the New World should stand as testimony to this fact. Meanwhile, if Westerners, or at least the dominant group among them, continue to nurse preconscious cues and sensibilities from their European past, modern Muslims remain locked in an epic conversation with a religious history bent on having a serious say in defining their identity in the modern world. Here, one need look no farther than such designations as Salafi, which is all about the news today, which highlight the normative status of Islam's pious ancestors in directing modern Muslims towards a proper understanding of the religion, a perspective, incidentally, by no means limited to those who explicitly identify as Salafis. In sum, historically informed, preconscious commitments and instincts continue to bind, animate, and inform both sides of this difficult conversation, the Islamic as well as the Western. Unlike our dreams, however, we might, as I hope to show, be able consciously to alter some of the more problematic effects of this. Exactly what do our respective pasts and liminal commitments contribute to the future of the relationship between Islam and violence? In an article entitled Jihad in the Modern World, which I wrote over a decade ago, just after the tragedy of 9/11, I concluded that there was a fundamental distinction between the place of and justification for jihad in the pre-modern versus the modern world. I had been prompted to write this piece by a segment on NPR, during which a woman called in and asked quite pointedly and half exasperated why the institution of jihad existed in the first place. After all, she intimated, had Islam not sanctioned the jihad to begin with, we might be spared, on the one hand, all these utterly unconvincing apologies on the part of Muslims, Islam means peace. Islam is a religion of peace. And the hijackers would have had a much more difficult time justifying their dastardly deeds to themselves or to anyone else. Of course, tucked in the seams of all of this was the insinuation that there was something sui generis about Islam as a religion. Because jihad was essentially a religious institution, the unspoken implication seemed to be that any stasis, let alone increase, in the degree of religious commitment on the part of Muslims could only mean a continuation, if not an increase, in the degree of danger they posed to America and the West. Closely examined, however, one detects in this way of thinking a subtle but significant element of projection. In fact, one senses that jihad is not so much a problem because of its alleged connection to wanton violence, but rather because it is grounded in the Islamic religion. For this fact binds Muslims to a theology and psychology of militarized confrontation that makes them impervious to rational engagement or any other secular calculus or process of negotiation. After all, religion, at least according to that Enlightenment narrative that informs the sensibilities of many, if not most Americans today, is commonly taken to be allergic to reason and antithetical to things secular. To this one might add the fact that, as everyone knows, Muslims remain deadly serious about matters of faith, even as the West continues in its fashionable move away from the quaint medieval obsession with religion. Returning to my anonymous interlocutor on NPR, my point of departure was the plain and simple fact that no honest depiction of jihad could deny its status as an institution sanctioned by the God of Islam. The question, however, of whether this placed it beyond rational critique and engagement was a separate matter altogether. In the Islamic legal tradition, jihad falls under the classification of civil transactions, the so-called mu'amalat, in contradistinction to religious observances, or ibadat. Among the chief distinctions between these two categories is that while the raison d'etre underlying religious observances is fixed and basically impervious to social political change, civil transactions, both in terms of their substance and their application, are subject to constant recalibration based on the extent to which the reason for which they were instituted is likely to be served. Because the reason underlying religious observances is the extolment of God, and God is constant, there is never any possibility of the obligation to carry out religious observances permanently lapsing. It is possible, on the other hand, even if not likely, for murderers and rapists to disappear from the face of the earth, at which time the aim behind the respective rules governing these actions would be realized, and there would be nothing to which to apply them. In other words, jihad could lapse. Of course, the whole key to this calculus revolves around the determination of the reasons underlying the rules governing civil transactions. And this raises perhaps the fundamental question about jihad. Is it for the purpose of emptying the earth of non-Islam? Or is there some other raison d'etre behind this institution? It would be convenient but plainly misleading to say that there was or is a unanimous consensus on this issue in either pre-modern or modern Islam. There was, however, a dominant thrust among the pre-modern doctors of Islamic law. And there is a similar trend growing among modern Muslim clerics and activists, including many who might otherwise be classified as radicals. And yet, the pre-modern jurists' penchant for disguising rather than acknowledging change, a tendency shared by all legal traditions according to the legal historian Alan Watson, has placed the negotiated nature of jihad beyond the recognition of many Western critics as well as many modern Muslims, including both those who produce as well as those who merely consume the latest Islamic currents and trends. In Jihad in the Modern World, I pointed out, relying in part on the work of modern Western historians of Islam, that going all the way back to the time of the Quranic revelation, Muslims lived in a world that could be characterized as constituting a state of war. As one noted Western historian of Islam put it, and I quote, In this society, war, used in the senses of both an activity and a condition, was in one sense a normal way of life. That is, a state of war was assumed to exist between one's tribe and all others, unless a particular treaty or agreement had been reached. Several Quranic verses confirm this state of affairs. For example, and I quote, "Do they not see that we established a safe haven in the sacred mosque while people all around them were being snatched away?" And similarly, they say, "O Muhammad, if we follow the guidance along with you, we shall be snatched away from our land." In fact, Arabia's endemic state of war drove the pre-Islamic Arabians in desperation to institute the so-called forbidden months in an effort to enable them to sustain the annual pan-Arabian pilgrimage. This innovation outlawed all acts of aggression initiated during the 11th, 12th, 1st, and 7th months. As the annual pilgrimage took place in the 12th lunar month, the forbidden months afforded the Arabians time to travel to and from Mecca in peace. The Quran confirms the sanctity of the forbidden months, and in so doing underscores the persistence of the overall state of war well into the time of Muhammad's mission. Along with its emphatic monotheism, Muhammad's message introduced another entirely new element into the Arabian theater, namely a community known as Muslims. Coming as they did from all the local clans and tribes, they constituted for a time a rather anomalous entity in a deeply conservative and deeply tribal society. In this context, the situation would ultimately gravitate towards the reality that the only people Muhammad's followers could assume would allow them to thrive as Muslims would be other Muslims themselves. Thus, while the Quranic injunction to wage jihad pit Muslims against non-Muslims, religion was hardly the only element in this confrontation. As de Tocqueville wrote of 19th century France, and I quote, "The unbelievers of Europe attacked the Christians as their political opponents rather than their religious adversaries." In a similar vein, speaking of the situation in the early United States, de Tocqueville cites the view of those who justified subjugating the Indians of the Western frontier in purely survivalist terms. Quote, "It is in our interest that the new territories should be religious in order that they may permit us to remain free," end of quote. Of course, Muhammad and the Muslims after him would strive to bring as many of the infidels as possible into the true faith. The question, however, is whether this was the raison d'etre of jihad, with nothing short of conversion fulfilling its basic purpose. The period after Muhammad's death would witness the massive expansion of Islam, or perhaps one should say of Muslim power, as the actual rate of conversion on the ground would not bring the conquered territories to a simple majority for at least a couple of centuries. Of course, in theory, non-Muslims were required to pay a special tax, the so-called jizya, in exchange for security and the right to practice their religion. Still, the overall state of war persisted, no less in the world of late antiquity than it had in Muhammad's Arabia. And jihad remained thus a priority for Muslims. And yet, that its purpose was widely understood to be the preservation of the physical integrity of the Muslim community rather than converting the entire world to Islam might be gleaned from such explicit articulations as those of the famous 12th of the Common Era century Spanish judge and jurist Ibn Rushd the Elder, a major authority in the history of Islamic law and the grandfather, incidentally, of the celebrated Averroes of Western fame. Summing up a lengthy discussion of jihad in his highly influential manual called Al-Muqaddimat, or First Things, Ibn Rushd writes the following. "Thus, whenever we are placed beyond the reach of the enemy, and the outlying districts of the Muslim lands are secured, and the gaps in their fortifications are filled, the obligation to wage jihad falls from all of the rest of the Muslims." Ibn Rushd clearly reflects here the sense that the basic aim of jihad is to provide for the physical integrity of the Muslim community. in a world perceived as holding Muslims under constant threat. Just how deeply ingrained this perception was might be measured by the fact that Ibn Rushd himself issued fatwas in which he banned Muslims from taking up residence abroad, prohibited them from traveling to foreign parts to do business, and required those who converted to Islam while living in non-Muslim territories to migrate to the lands of Islam. Such sensibilities might be difficult for us to understand today, but we might be reminded that while Christian, Jewish, and even Zoroastrian communities might be able to sustain a sense of community in Muslim Iberia, Cairo, or Shiraz, as Norman Daniel points out in his classic book, Islam in the West, Christian tolerance of Muslim communities in the pre-modern West was quite a mercurial affair. In the long run, he writes, and I quote, it was only Islam that tolerated other religions within, admittedly only with second-class citizenship. In sum, my answer to the question of why Islam sanctioned jihad to begin with was that the religion itself was born into a world where organized violence underwrote a community's ability to survive and sustain itself. Indeed, given the overall state of war prevailing both in Arabia and then the world into which Islam subsequently spread, it would have been odd, if not grotesque, if such an institution or its functional equivalent had not emerged. Rather than limit oneself, then, to Islamic scripture or religion, as my NPR interlocutor seemed to have been prone to do, a more accurate understanding of jihad requires an appreciation of Muslim history. Indeed, it would be more with history than with scripture that the jurists would remain in conversation as they went about the business of negotiating the contours and application of jihad as an institution. Of course, this understanding of the role and purpose of jihad was not and is not shared by all. As one influential Western scholar describes it in its classical guise, jihad, and here I quote again, is directed against the infidels who need not be guilty of any act of hostility against Muslims. Their very existence is a cause for war, and its aim is to incorporate the infidels in the abode of Islam, preferably as converts, but alternatively as dhimmis, the so-called protected minorities, until the whole world has been subdued. This view is actually confirmed by one of the four orthodox Sunni schools of law. The going opinion of the classical Shafi'i school was precisely that the mere unbelief of unbelievers, not their aggression, was not only a justification but a bona fide legal cause obligating jihad against them. In essence, if not precisely in form, this is also the view of those modern Muslim radicals who hold it to be a communal obligation upon Muslims to wage perpetual war against the entire world until the whole globe embraces Islam or agrees to pay the minority tax. Thus, it is not at all the case that only non-Muslim Western critics are those who simply have inadequate access to the sources and or tradition of Islam understand jihad as a fundamental contradiction of the principle of live and let live. And yet, the minority position of the Shafi'i school aside, there is an extent to which Western alarmists and violent Muslim radicals seem to share and proceed on the basis of a very particular historical consciousness. Western critics often appear to embrace a form of historical determinism, according to which Islam cannot, in good conscience or with any integrity, evolve beyond what it was at some arbitrarily chosen point in the past, except as an admission of inadequacy or dereliction. In this sense, it is history that makes Muslims. Muslims do not make history. Jewish and Christian traditions may be accepted as having evolved to the point that not every medieval interpretation is understood to constitute binding orthodoxy. But if Muslims signal a similar move, this is viewed as suspect, if not duplicitous, taqiyya, as many have branded it. Meanwhile, in their own way, violent Muslim radicals note a similar, if not identical, attitude. romantic recollections of an imperial Islamic past continue to bind them to a singular reading of the Muslim present, divergence from which is condemned as an act of religious treason. But this was clearly not the approach of the pre-modern masters themselves, from whom the authority for this frozen historical consciousness is supposed to be derived. As we saw clearly in the case of Ibn Rushd, and I could cite countless others, changes in the factual, that is, historical circumstances on the ground, could warrant, and indeed necessarily warranted, substantive changes in the applicability of the obligation to wage jihad. In jihad in the modern world, I argued that such change had actually occurred in the form of modern notions such as territorial sovereignty and modern institutions such as the United Nations. This, I argued, effectively replaced the medieval state of war with a modern state of peace, at least in the sense that peace, not war, now constitutes the presumed norm. Recognition of this fact, certainly given the example of the likes of Ibn Rushd and the classical tradition, would seem to go a long way in reducing the role of violence in Islam as the preferred medium of exchange. But a Western or a Muslim historical consciousness that freezes and shackles Islamic normativeness to a particular pre-modern relationship between Islam and the world will only be able to look upon such changes agnostically, if not with a deep sense of resentment, if not contempt. There are, however, signs that the wages of this frozen historical consciousness are increasingly being recognized and explicitly rejected by modern Muslims. And perhaps one could cite no better example of this than the highly influential Egyptian-born cleric Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who was actually born in 1926. In his most recent opus, his two-volume Fiqh al-Jihad, or The Jurisprudence of Jihad, Sheikh al-Qaradawi sets out to privilege what he terms moderation, or the middle way, as the normative position for Muslims. Regarding jihad, he places this position between what he depicts as two extremes. On the one end are those who would jettison jihad altogether, limiting themselves to a spiritual struggle against the enemy within. On the other extreme are those who see organized violence as the only medium of exchange between them and their adversaries, both Muslim and non-Muslim alike. Al-Qaradawi dismisses both of these positions as flawed, but it is the latter group, the hawks as he calls them, that form the primary focus of his attack. Al-Qaradawi's primary targets is the tendency to accept the historical reality and perspective of the ancients as the historical perspective of Islam, and from there to process the data of scripture on the basis thereof. On such an approach, modern Muslims can hardly move beyond the conclusions of their pre-modern forebears. For if the latter lived in a world that could be characterized as constituting a state of war and processed the scriptural injunctions on jihad on that basis, modern Muslims who uncritically follow them will invariably be led to similar, if not identical, conclusions. But al-Qaradawi is clear that pre-modern and modern Muslims are separated by distinct socio-political realities. As such, the textual interpretations of the ancients made on the basis of their reality should not be granted any unassailable authority in the modern world. As he put it, and I'm going to quote here, "True jurisprudence is not simply transmitting the contents of books, for books reflect their respective times and places. True jurisprudence obtains when the jurist engages in fresh interpretation for his own time and place, just as the ancients did for theirs. Not everything that is appropriate for one time is necessarily appropriate for another, and not everything that is appropriate to one place is necessarily appropriate to another, especially given that the changes that have obtained in these our modern times are so very substantial indeed." End of quote. For al-Qaradawi, ignoring the space-time differential between pre-modern and modern times leads to the problem of subsequent generations getting shackled to bygone histories in the name of a normative commitment to religious texts, and then laboring under the assumption that all juristic or religious meaning is independently dictated by the texts themselves. On this understanding, the only way to challenge or revise a particular rule is to challenge or revise the authority or authenticity of the text upon which it is based. Not only does Al-Qaradawi dismiss this approach as methodologically flawed, he points out that it is not likely to go far with the majority of committed Muslims. As an alternative, Al-Qaradawi insists that it is contemporary and not pre-modern reality that must serve as the basis of modern Muslims' deliberations. And for him, contemporary reality is simply no longer the medieval state of war. While prejudice and anti-Muslim feelings persist, it is no longer the case that all non-Muslims are simply lying in wait to pounce on Muslims militarily at the first opportunity. Nor is it the case that Muslims cannot establish and sustain a sense of community in non-Muslim lands. Nor, given the advances in modern technology and communication, can it be presumed that the powers and principalities that oppose Islam can prevent Muslims from spreading their religious message, as they might have been able to do in the past. To be sure, there are indeed hawks to be found among non-Muslims. And against these, Muslims, insists Al-Qaradawi, must remain ready to prosecute the jihad. But this, Al-Qaradawi intimates, is the exception rather than the rule. And in this light, he declares boldly and explicitly that in these our modern times, jihad is primarily a defensive mechanism directed against, and I quote, those who attack the persons, property, lands, or religion of the Muslims in an attempt to undermine the latter or block the path to it, or to those who oppress the weak among the Muslims or their allies, end of quote. Of course, we should not be so taken by the perceived novelty of Al-Qaradawi's approach that we are led to misread him. Indeed, it is important to recognize that he does not see the transition from a modern to a pre-modern frame of reference to be something that Muslims can either engender or sustain unilaterally. As an ontological reality in actual existence outside the Muslim mind, the modern state of peace as opposed to the pre-modern state of war, is fundamentally informed, if not instantiated, by the actions of powerful Western nations, especially the United States. Thus, if the Muslim rereading of jihad in the modern world is to enjoy any depth and permanence, non-Muslims, according to Al-Qaradawi, will have to conduct themselves towards Muslims in a manner that does not represent, in effect, a return to the medieval state of war. Al-Qaradawi is, of course, a formally trained cleric. As such, his articulations might be looked upon as exceptional, being limited to the most formally educated and those who follow their cue. This is especially relevant in the present context, given the fact that violent Muslim radicalism has been virtually the exclusive preserve of non-clerical actors. Bin Laden, for example, was an engineer. Ayman al-Zawahiri is a medical doctor. And the Taliban are known, quite known, for being quite juristically challenged. I would like to end my presentation, thus, with what I hope will confirm my claim of the growing diffusion of a Muslim historical consciousness that denies the primacy of violence as the normative medium of exchange between Islam and the other. Many of you are perhaps old enough to remember, perhaps not, the assassination of President Anwar Sadat in 1981. This event, along with others such as the 1979 Iranian Revolution, the 1979 takeover of the Grand Mosque in Mecca, and the 1982 bombing of the Marine Barracks in Beirut, was among the major confirmations of the arrival of radical Islamic revivalism. The group that assassinated Sadat, Tanzim al-Jihad, or the Jihad Organization, was actually an amalgamation of a number of groups, the largest and most influential of which being the so-called Gamaa Islamiyah. Following Sadat's murder, the Gamaa ended up swelling Egyptian prisons, and by the early 1990s, it is estimated that between 15 and 30,000 of its members languished in Egyptian jails. Throughout this period, however, their bloody confrontations with the Egyptian state and society continued, to the tune of taking literally thousands of lives, including Coptic Christians, secularists, foreign tourists, and even high government officials, not to mention innocent Muslim bystanders. But on July 5th, 1997, the incarcerated leadership of the Jamaa Islamiya stunned the nation. They announced a unilateral, unconditional end to all violent campaigns, both within and outside of Egypt. This was the beginning of what they would come to refer to as the initiative to stop the violence. In 2002, the Jamaa leadership, most of whom were still in prison, issued a series of four corrective manifestos in which they set out to correct the misunderstandings that had guided their actions in the past. Chief among these is the idea that jihad is a means and not an end, the normative end for Muslims being to guide, not coerce, humanity into a proper relationship with God. Jihad might play a supportive role, as for example, when Muslims are prevented from calling others to the faith. But this is obviously the exception. And at any rate, jihad should never be executed at the expense of Islam's primary mission. And it should never be prosecuted under circumstances where it is not likely to serve its stated goal. This is what the Jamaa leadership says it failed to understand in the past. And this is why they proclaim that they were wrong to kill Anwar al-Sadat and wrong to declare war on Egyptian society. A major part of the Jamaa's self-critique, however, is its recognition of the necessity of processing the data of scripture in light of the actual social-political circumstances on the ground, as opposed to assuming that it is one's religious duty to pursue some changeless, transcendent application of scripture, or that the circumstances of the past continue automatically into the present as the normative, presumably Islamic, basis of deliberation. To this end, in an interview in 2004, shortly after his release from prison, Karam Zuhdi, the uncontested leader of the Jamaa, stated explicitly, I quote, "Islamic history is not an authoritative source of Sharia rules," end of quote. "Rather, it is contemporary reality, as assessed by contemporary Muslims, that must be looked to as the ground for concretizing the meaning of scripture." Indeed, in the first installment of their series of corrective manifestos, the Jamaa leadership insists explicitly, and I quote here, "It is clear error to assume positions, establish rulings, or issue fatwas removed from a consideration of the actual reality on the ground and a comprehensive assessment of its implications, considering this a fundamental pillar upon which all fatwas must be based. Indeed, all rulings and all fatwas must recline upon two fundamental constituents: one, reality on the ground and its implications, and two, the Quran, the example of the Prophet, and other recognized sources of Sharia." To this heightened sense of historical consciousness, the Jamaa adds the value of religious practicality. In a word, they conclude that their violent confrontations with the Egyptian state and society ultimately served no purpose. And ultimately, the reason it served no purpose was that violence has simply lost much of its effectiveness in the modern world, especially where the aim is to change hearts and minds. Again, there may be circumstances where the duty to engage in jihad cannot be put aside, but this should not seduce one into thinking that violence can serve as some kind of geopolitical panacea, given the realities of the modern world as we have come to know it today. It is this insight that ultimately takes the Jamaa beyond Egypt to a critique of contemporary jihadism in general and of Al-Qaeda in particular. This is exhaustively laid out in a book they published in 2004, Al-Qaeda's Bombings and Strategies. Al-Qaeda's Strategies and Bombings, Mistakes and Dangers. Again, the basic critique of Al-Qaeda is that the latter misunderstands the rules and purpose of jihad, while also ignoring or misapprehending contemporary reality. This leads Al-Qaeda to a misapplication of jihad and to consequences that actually undermine rather than serve its basic purpose. Of course, none of this is meant to suggest than my approval of America's negative or imperial role in the region. They repeatedly point to America's bias vis-a-vis the Arab-Israeli conflict, its hypocritical, self-serving promotion of democracy, human rights, and the protection of religious minorities and women, not to mention the United States' economic exploits and ambitions in the region. In the face of all of this, the Gamma's message is emphatically not one of grin and bear it. It is simply to question the effectiveness from the standpoint of reality and the validity from the standpoint of Sharia of the kind of wanton violence and bellicosity advocated by Al-Qaeda. For if the overall aim of this jihadism is, as it must be from the standpoint of the religious law, to promote the interest of Islam, not only has it not done this, it has gone so far as to turn the entire world not only against Al-Qaeda, but also against Islam as a whole. Space will not permit a full expose of the extent to which the Gamma as a non-clerical, radical, and by some measure, extremist group has abandoned the frozen historical consciousness that continues to underwrite the tendency to see Islam as being inextricably wedded to violence. Rather than overstate my case, however, I would like to close with a few observations, comments perhaps, maybe. First, none of what I have said here should be taken to imply or suggest that the global Muslim community ceases to include members who see it as their duty, in fact, their religious duty, to wage perpetual war against the West. I would suggest, however, that the efforts of formerly trained clerics such as Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi, and especially the interventions of groups such as the Gamaa Islamiyya, given their massive street credibility among radical groups, have sparked a new conversation in Islam. While it would be naive to think that this will terminate once and for all the problem of violent extremist ideology, it is likely to go a long way in complicating the efforts of young radical jihadis to imply that only sellouts or hypocrites or those who are lukewarm in their commitment to Islam could possibly object to their understanding of jihad as war against the world. Second, the articulations of the Sheikh Yusuf's and the Gamma Islamiyya's are authentic to the core. And while they might not represent the view of all Muslims, these advocates and all who identify with them should be taken at their word when they state that this is the Islam to which they are committed. Finally, it may be time for the West to rethink the notion that only secularization or the manufacturing of moderate, serious commitment to their religion will ultimately cure Muslims of their addiction to violence and therefore provide for a better, safer world. For the critiques we have seen in this presentation are thoroughly grounded in Sharia, and the advocates thereof have done so out of the very deepest and most sincere sense of religious commitment. Thank you very much.